This is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast episode number 141. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Joseph Atwill, titled Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus, and is being released on Sunday, April 1st, 2012. My interview with Joseph was recorded on Wednesday, March 28, 2012. And it's Happy Fool's Day, but this interview is no joke. Joseph Atwill spent his youth in Japan, where he attended the only English-speaking school in the country, St. Mary's Military Academy. The school was run by Jesuits so removed from the events of the modern world that they did not even consider shutting it down during World War II, and taught a curriculum that had not changed since the 18th century. Joseph Atwill describes that, quote, "The majority of every one of my school days was spent studying Greek, Latin, and the Bible, which for some reason I found fascinating. After studying computer science in college, Atwill began working for one of the most renowned programmers in the world, David Ferguson. David had been granted the first two patents ever issued in computer software. Over the next 20 years, between 1975 and 1995, David Ferguson and Joseph Atwill started a series of companies, including Ferguson Tool Company and ASNA. And, quoting Atwill, "After selling my interest in our companies to investors in 1995, I returned to my earlier interest, the origins of Christianity." And Atwill continues, "Though I had drifted away from the Catholic faith, my study of Christianity never stopped. Over the course of my life, I had read perhaps 600 or 700 books relating to the historical Jesus and early Christianity, but none of them left me feeling like I really knew anything about how the religion began or its founder." Atwill contends that the more he studied Christian origins, the more he saw the question of how the religion began as an open one. Atwill held his position in spite of the fact that in popular mind and in the minds of most scholars, Christianity began as a movement of the lower class followers of a radical Jewish teacher in the first century CE. Atwill says, quote, "And I did not share in this certainty. What contributed most to his skepticism was that at the exact same time the followers of Jesus were purportedly organizing themselves into a religion that urged its members to, quote, turn the other cheek, end quote, and to, quote, give to Caesar what is Caesar's, end quote, another Judean sect was waging a religious war against the Romans and seeking a Messiah who would lead them militarily." Atwill continues, quote, "It seemed implausible to me that the two diametrically opposite forms of Messianic Judaism would have emerged from Judea at the same time. So the Dead Sea Scrolls became of such interest to me that I began what turned into a decade-long study of them. Like others, Atwill was hoping to learn something about Christian's origin in the 2,000-year-old documents found at Qumran. To assist in his understanding of them, Atwill began studying the history of that era. It was then that Joseph Atwill came across the key that led to his discoveries. While reading Josephus's War of the Jews and his account of Titus's destruction of Jerusalem in 70 CE, Atwill recounts, I noticed some curious parallels. At first, I could make no sense of the parallels between Titus's campaign and Jesus's ministry. So I tried to look at the Gospels with fresh eyes, as if I had never seen them before, giving up any preconceived notions about what they meant. This perspective resulted in the discoveries Atwill presents in Caesar's Messiah and his soon-to-be-published book, The Single Strand. And a Roman imperial family, the Flavians, had created Christianity, and even more incredibly, they had placed a literary satire within the Gospels and the War of the Jews to inform posterity of this fact. Understanding the symbolic framework for the Gospels opened up the history of Western civilization to Joseph Atwill. That framework enabled him to recognize the typology that underlies authors such as Marlowe and Shakespeare and see the incredible story their typology tells us, and is the basis for The Single Strand. Joseph Atwill concludes, quote, I am an avid chess player and proud to state that I have more than 100 chess victories over grandmasters and international masters. I hold an ICC master's rating of 2358. It is this form of strategic thinking that enabled Atwill to uncover the strategy behind the Romans' invention of the Gospels. And books by Atwill include Caesar's Messiah, 2006, and it was a best-selling work of religious history in the U.S. in 2007, and its German translation, Das Messias Ratzel, published by Ulstein in 2008, achieved the number one bestseller status. Atwill's upcoming book, The Single Strand, is also slated to be published by Ulstein, and the German magazine Focus published a cover article of Atwill's work in issue number 2 in December 25, 2008. And upcoming shows, we're going to crank up the politically incorrect knob a bit and have Gilad Atzmon on to discuss Zionism and his book, The Wondering Who. And in fact, Gilad's grandfather was a Zionist terrorist. And also, we plan to have Jason Martineau on, and Richard Grove, and Kevin Cole, and Robert Forty, and a few others. And let's see. Donations. This episode is dedicated to Sam, John, Max, David, Paul, Tad, Angela, and Janet. And the widget for the video and book project for The Secret History of the Magic Mushroom expired, and so I had to put a new one up. The old one reached 14% or about $2,200, so I started the new one from there. And a little bit about the project. First of all, Wasson served as a chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was director of the Free Russia Fund, Inc. He worked as VP to J.P. Morgan Bank at 23 Wall Street, a.k.a. The Corner. Wasson served as PR or propaganda vice president for J.P. Morgan and helped to sell the current financial system created by his boss. And in fact, Wasson's direct boss, Henry Davison, was at Jekyll Island. And for those of you who were here back in the beginning, I interviewed Eustace Mullins about his book, Secrets of the Federal Reserve, that goes into all of that. And Wasson also had close ties to Alan Dulles, who is the head of the CIA, and there is documentation that Wasson was possibly CIA himself. Wasson earned a directorship at a pharmaceutical company for his mushroom discovery, and one of those was possibly at Sandoz, and he could have even been over Albert Hofmann, if that information in fact checks out. And Wasson was an account manager to the Pope and the Vatican for J.P. Morgan Bank, and this actually reveals quite an agenda to protect as well. And this is an interesting twist. Wasson was in charge of promoting the Russian Orthodox Church for Russian immigrants for the U.S., and this reveals another agenda to protect. And Wasson had a Russian wife, Valentina Pavlovna Wasson, and she was religious, and that also shows an agenda to protect. And Valentina was also from the Russian intelligentsia, or Russian elite. And I think that their story of collecting mushrooms as a Russian peasant in the woods on their honeymoon in New York seems patently absurd. And this was actually pointed out by Wasson's daughter, which is found in Thomas Reidlinger's book, The Sacred Mushroom Seeker. And Wasson also plagiarized many of his ideas on Soma from John G. Bork's book on Scatology from 1892. And primary documents reveal that Wasson was involved in helping to cover up J.P. Morgan's involvement in the Civil War's Hall Carbine affair, and that Wasson directed or was heavily involved in the disinformation campaign. And it appears that this act was probably what earned Wasson the position as vice president for J.P. Morgan Bank. And Wasson's direct boss at J.P. Morgan, Henry Davison, was Skull and Bones. Also, Henry Luce at Time Life was Skull and Bones, and Davison created Time Life for his boss, J.P. Morgan. And they also brought on C.D. Jackson, who is head of U.S. psychological warfare there at Time Life, and he's famous for purchasing the Zapruder film of JFK's assassination. And he's also famous for the footage at the Buchenwald camp during World War II. Jackson later became president of Time Life, and Wasson always claimed that by a chance meeting with Luce that he published his Seeking the Magic Mushroom article in May 1957 with Life magazine. However, Wasson and Luce were also longtime members of the Century Club together, and Wasson launched a campaign to destroy John Allegro's work before it was even available, and all of Wasson's claims against Allegro have been disproved, and I showed that in my 2008 book, as well as Wasson covered up that Andrea Puhoric was CIA, Army, and MK Ultra when he attacked Allegro using Puhoric and calling Puhoric merely a man. And in fact, Wasson was runner-up, one of eight, in fact, as chairman to the Securities and Exchange Commission running Wall Street and the New York Stock Exchange. and Wasson authored the Stock Exchange Act. Wasson launched the psychedelic revolution. Wasson was associated to no less than six persons suspected of being involved in the JFK assassination, including Jackson and Luce, already mentioned, and primary documents also reveal that Wasson was close friends with George de Morenshield, who, of course, was close friends with Lee Harvey Oswald, and Wasson was also tied to the Zapruder film through George de Morenshield's wife, who worked for none other than Abe Zapruder, and of course, de Morenshield working with Wasson. And when de Morenshield was suicided, Wasson's number was found in his pocket, along with others such as George H.W. Bush, who's been another suspect in the JFK assassination. And Wasson was close friends with Edward Bernays, who he hung out with for at least a decade. And Bernays is the father of propaganda and spin, a nephew to Sigmund Freud. And he was also a large influence on Goebbels, who was in charge of Nazi propaganda. And Wasson was on the executive committee for the research program on the USSR, and Wasson served as chairman to the Committee for the Promotion of Advanced Slavic Cultural Studies. Wasson was in a top position in the Century Club, it appears, and the Century Club is an elite CIA-OSS intelligence front posing as an exclusive art club, and Wasson gave lectures there, one of which I've actually been able to acquire a recording of. Him giving a lecture there to intelligence members and elite and on his mushroom research. And Wasson also ran the Russian Student Fund, Inc. for the CIA. And Wasson also nominated John Foster Dulles, Walter Lippmann, George Keenan, and other nefarious characters into the Century Club. Wasson was also friends with George Keenan, who is one of the people behind Operation Paperclip, a program to secretly bring Nazi officials and scientists into the USA and elsewhere for research and other covert purposes. And of course, all of the information on Operation Paperclip has long been public. And the Wasson family, by the way, has intentionally been involved in suppressing this information and has prevented access to the Wasson archives at Harvard to anyone who does not uphold the current Wassonian myth. And the Wasson family actually requires all researchers to tell them exactly what they're going to say about Wasson before they've actually seen any of the documentation, if you can believe that. And so what we're doing is, if you donate $50 or more to the project, I'll send you a Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. If you donate $100 or more, I'll send you a copy of the first 3 years of the Gnostic Media Podcast. And if you donate $200 or more, I'll send you the She Who Remembers audio archives, this show's archives, and the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD. And of course, we do need all the funds we can get our hands on to get this project going, and the sooner the better. So I really appreciate your help. And to those who've already donated to the project, you'll be listed along with the project rather than here for donations for the podcast. And we do still need some equipment purchases. We need Pro Tools and a large size monitor and a video camera. And we do our best to provide everything here for free. So if you can help, it's greatly appreciated. This show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating to this program or ordering one of the books or a DVD or the She Remembers archives or a t-shirt or getting a membership to download stuff or whatever, you help to continue this unprogramming, and we greatly appreciate your support. And the views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself or Gnostic Media. Check out the website at www.gnosticmedia.com. That's GNOSTICmedia.com, and you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. And please also check out Tragedy and Hope and the Peace Revolution podcast, the School Sucks podcast with Brett Vinat, James Corbett's Corbett Report, James Evan Pilato, etc. Thank you for listening and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Joseph Atwill, Caesar's Messiah. Enjoy. Welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. I'm glad to have you here. And a few weeks ago, I had heard you on Henrik Palmgren's show, Red Ice Radio, and I thought it was a fantastic interview, and associates of mine have brought up your research over a number of years, and in fact, I had an older version of your book on my Amazon wish list for years, just waiting for the time and money to order it and get it read and actually get you on the show. So when I heard you on Henrik's show, I took the opportunity to reach out to you, and you had been a topic of recent discussion and debate in one of our scholarly discussion circles. So I wanted to get you on the show, so welcome aboard, and it's good to have you here.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me on.
And why don't we start off with a little bit about you and your educational background?
Well, the most important part of it is that I didn't study anything to do with religious studies or the history of the era that the Gospels were produced in college. My background is in computer science. I have a strange connection into Christianity. I was raised in Japan and went to a Jesuit military academy, which was the only English-speaking school in the country at the time, called St. Mary's Military Academy. And so as a very young person, between kindergarten and fifth grade, I studied the Gospels from the perspective of the Jesuits, which is very rigorous. There's quite a bit of analysis. It's not just catechism. They want you to understand the literature. And I think that background, if nothing else, gave me a strong curiosity about Jesus, about the history of Christianity. And even though I fell away from the faith as I went through life, I did retain curiosity about the religion. And when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, I sort of re-engendered my study of the Gospels, because the Dead Sea Scrolls were so different than the theology that the Gospels were presenting. In other words, in the Gospels, you have a pacifist Christ, someone who is pro-Roman, advocates his followers to turn the other cheek and to give to Caesar what is Caesar's. But in the Dead Sea Scrolls, you had a different messianic theology. Even though that group used the same theological structure, the predictions about a Messiah in the Torah as the basis for their religion, they came to a completely different perspective. They were xenophobic. They were militaristic. They wanted to drive the foreigners and the Romans out of the country. And so I just had the question come up to me as, how did these two sects coexist in the same era side by side? And so this is really was the foundation of the research I started to do as an adult.
Let's get into the Flavian Emperor Titus. Why is he important to Christianity?
Well, he is important to Christianity because the story of Jesus that the Gospels present is actually a kind of prophecy of Titus's military campaign through Judea. The Flavians were a family of Caesars. There was Vespasian, who was Titus's father, Titus, who was his oldest son, and Domitian, the younger son. And these three, incidentally, are represented as the Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost in Christianity. These Caesars waged a long and vicious battle against the Messianic movement. And following the war, they were looking for an alternative to the violent Messianic theology that had inspired the rebellion that they had to fight against. And so this was the overt reason that they then decided to produce the Gospels. Now, when they wrote the Gospels, they created it as typology, and at this point it gets complicated because you have to understand what the genre of typology actually is. And it is a difficult genre to understand, but unfortunately it's absolutely necessary. You really can't understand the history of Western civilization if you don't understand typology, because it is really the foundation of our literature. It is absolutely the genre that the Gospels are written in, and the typology, in other words, the life of Jesus, all of the events he has, the prophecies that he makes, They are all related to Titus Flavius. They are related to the military campaign that Titus waged in Judea in the first century.
Who was Flavius Josephus, and why is he important to the origins of Christianity?
Well, Flavius Josephus was the court historian of the Flavians, and following the war against the Messianic movement, the Flavians brought Josephus back to their imperial court. They instructed him to write the history of the war. And the history that he wrote is very fundamental to understanding Christianity. In fact, though it's been forgotten somehow in our current generation of theologians, for the first 1900 years of Christianity, the prophecies that Jesus made were all seen to have come to pass in the histories of Josephus. If you read Eusebius, St. Augustine, Tertullian, all of these individuals talk about how amazing it is that Jesus could see into the future. And they, when they make these statements, they're specifically talking about the history of Josephus. So that in the when the Gospels were first printed and in some of the very early handwritten versions, they actually included the history of Josephus with the other books. So Josephus is completely integral to Christianity. He wrote the history. Just to give you an example, Jesus makes predictions about the Galilean towns being destroyed, the city of Jerusalem being encircled, the temple being razed. There will be an abomination of desolation. Now, these things were, in fact, military victories of Titus Flavius that Josephus recorded. And all of the early theologians connected one event, in other words, the prophecy that Jesus made, to the historical recording that of the event that Josephus wrote in his history.
In your book, you claim or show that Josephus wrote much of the Gospels and that he had to basically interweave these into the stories. And you also say that Josephus was basically writing a lampoon against the resistance movement in Jerusalem. So what is the satire, this lampoon, and why use a satire or lampoon in writing the New Testament or the Gospel stories?
Well, the Flavians simply hated the Messianic movement. There are historians that record that both Titus and Vespasian, who were fighting this battle, suffered injuries during the war. In fact, one tradition has it that Titus actually lost the use of one of his arms because he'd been struck with a stone. So the people who are producing the Gospels just hated the Messianic movement that they fought against. And so when they created the story, they made it as a mockery of them. Just to give you an example of how the genre works, at the beginning of his ministry, Jesus comes to the Sea of Galilee. He gathers his troops, his disciples, to him, and he says, "Don't be afraid, follow me, and you will become fishers of men." Well, since everything that Jesus does is a kind of prediction, a typologic prediction of Titus's military campaign, when Titus begins his campaign, he comes to the same location. He gathers his disciples or his troops around him. He says, "Do not be afraid, follow me." And then they go and attack the Jewish fishing fleet. They sink the boats. The Jews attempt to swim to safety, and they catch them like fish. So Jesus is essentially seemingly talking about a spiritual catching of men or fishing for men. But in fact, he's operating as almost a straight man, something like a Martin and Lewis, where he is actually, even though it sounds spiritual, there is a literal mockery meaning that is the actual intent of the authors.
In your book, you start off with Josephus's tale of soldiers witnessing a woman by the name of Mary, who had done what?
Well, you're referring to Cannibal Mary, and she's probably the most famous non-gospel character from the era. Tremendous amount of scholarly literature about this individual. Mary was a individual inside Jerusalem who, during the siege of Jerusalem, began to starve to death. And she then ate her son to quench her hunger. In the passages that Josephus wrote about the event, he set the son up as a Passover lamb. In other words, he described the son as being from the house of hyssop and a roasted sacrifice. You have to know a little bit about Judaism, but the roasted sacrifice of the house of hyssop is the Passover lamb. And she described the son as her sacrifice. So this is clear symbolic language to establish the son as a Passover lamb, and the son is then eaten. There is a point, a typologic point, to what Josephus is writing, and that is that if you're following in the sequence of parallels between that Josephus shares with the Gospels, at the point in the Gospels that the human Passover lamb in Josephus occurs, you have the Last Supper, where Jesus establishes himself as a human Passover lamb. He says that essentially very clearly that I am the Passover lamb, and you will have no life in you if you do not eat of my flesh and drink of my blood. And so scholars have always wondered, what in the heck is this language doing in here? The Jewish religion is very particular about dietary rules. God does not, in the dietary instructions to the Jews, give them permission to engage in cannibalism. So why is this symbolism even in the Gospels? Well, if you understand that the Gospels are a kind of prediction of the military campaign of the Flavians, then it makes perfect sense. The two events are just related. One predicts the other. The human Passover lamb in Josephus simply foresees the human Passover lamb that Titus Flavius encountered when he conquered Jerusalem.
And so eventually that leads to the story of eating Jesus' flesh. And right. You claim that there were several, and that Titus was just one of those.
Right. I mean, Jesus Christ is simply a title. It's not really the name of an individual. Christ is a title. It's found throughout the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example.
Well, you know, some scholars have traced the word Christ all the way back to chrism and Christos, which means oil, and then they've traced it from there into ancient fertility worship and anointing with semen.
Sure. I mean, there's just no end sort of to the stream of theology that the religions kind of use or borrow from. Amalgamate as they move forward. In the Gospels, the individual has a very specific reason for being the Christ, and that is that the movement of Jews that the Flavians fought against was a messianic movement. Josephus wrote that what most drove the Jews to rebel against Caesar was their belief in a coming world ruler who was a Jew. Now, these are the prophecies in the Torah that relate to the branch of David, the root of Jesse, this messianic lineage, and that was what propelled the Jews to rebel against the Roman Empire. According to Josephus, that was the most important reason. So the Flavians wanted to become the Christ, and they wanted to take this prophecy and apply it to themselves. And so the Gospels are just a very kind of complicated way of showing that the Flavians have become the Christ of the Jews. They have won the title as a trophy of war. The Gospels have a character that Jesus predicts called, that he refers to as the Son of Man. And he says that the Son of Man is going to come. He will come before the generation that I'm talking to passes away. And when he comes, all these bad things will happen. You're going to have the cities in Galilee will be laid low. Jerusalem will be encircled. The temple will be razed. The abomination of desolation that Daniel predicted will occur. He says all these terrible things will happen. So this essentially is a very clear prediction that Jesus is making of Titus. So that Christianity is actually, though it seemingly worships Jesus Christ the Jew, it actually worships the Son of Man that Jesus is predicting. And that individual is Titus Flavius. So what the Caesars did was to bend the prophecies that the Torah has in that predict a world ruler who will be Jewish. They bend these prophecies in the gospel with all these fantasy events and all of these strange applications of the prophecies, and you end up with the Son of Man that Jesus predicts really being the Christ that Christianity worships. So even though the Christians have thought they were worshiping this character, Jesus Christ, who was crucified, actually the real Messiah of the religion is the Son of Man who comes within 40 years from Jesus' ministry, and that is Titus Flavius.
In how many ways does Eliezer or Lazarus tie into the Jesus story?
Well, Eleazar was the name of the real Christ. There are coins from the era that talk about two individuals, a Simon and an Eleazar, and they denote Eli as the religious individual. They call him the priest. These coins were minted by the Messianic movement once they had driven the Roman legions out of Judea. The Messianic movement drove the Roman soldiers out of Judea in 66, and they set up their own nation inside the Roman Empire. They actually had a government, and they were minting coins. And the coins reflect this this priest, this Eleazar, who would have been the real Christ. Now, this individual is lampooned as Lazarus, which is simply the Greek expression for Eleazar, the Hebrew Eleazar. Lazarus is a lampoon of the real Christ that had led the zealots against Rome.
When you say the real Christ, you mean he was a militant leader.
He was a military leader, exactly. He was a military leader, and he.
We're not talking about the warm fuzzy bunny type of Jesus that Christians think of today.
No, that character is a complete fantasy. It was developed by the Romans simply to pacify the Messianic movement. The character is just unhistorical from the get-go. You have the Christ being of the lineage of David. Just think of David, what David was like. This was the guy who fought Goliath. So this was the real Christ. The real Christ was always been seen as a military leader by the Jews. The character developed in the Gospels is not real. He is a fictional character that was specifically developed to counterbalance the military version of the Christ that the Jews actually looked for. The individual who led the Messianic movement against Rome in the first century, he was a military leader. That was the real Christ. And incidentally, that individual was captured on the Mount of Olives and was crucified. So this is where those components of the story in the gospel actually come from, is these historical events that occurred during Titus's campaign.
Now, one thing that I would like to point out to the audience, and I'm sure the audience has got to be wondering now, Jan, why would you be having someone on? Because you've published books regarding Judeo-Christianity and Jesus's association to the sun and astrotheology and to mushrooms, and you've republished John Allegro's work. You know, I just want to point out to the audience here that your work and your interpretation of how the Flavius family usurped Judaism and the pagan religions and all of these ideals at the time and put their belief in there doesn't really change how these stories were earlier based on astrotheology and on entheogens and things like this. It's, you know, these religions were there, they usurped the beliefs that were there, and then what they did was, after that fact, they still, as Christianity spread across Europe, they destroyed the pagan religions and brought those ideals and beliefs in on top of Christianity, such as the Christmas celebration and things like that, bringing the tree into the home. So I just wanted to clarify these things for the audience that, you know, I don't really see, except for maybe in a couple of spots, I don't really see any contradictions at all between your work and my work, or Acharya S's, D.M. Murdoch's work, and these other people.
No, in fact, my work actually supports it and provides a kind of explanation for some of the questions. Because when you look at Christianity, you have a top-down authority structure that is apparently based on the Roman military authority structure. And a natural question is, well, how did a religion or that had these connections to mystery cults and Gnosticism end up with this particular authoritative structure? It begs a question. And so a good mystery that it clears up, for example, is the Gnostic Gospels. The Gnostic Gospels use the characters in the Gospels. You see, you know, Jesus and Mary and the apostles, but the structure of the theology it's presenting is asking that the Christians, the people who are reading the material, find their own spiritual path. Now, this is completely in opposition to the authority structure of Roman
Christianity. Right, then Titus saying, I am God, exactly. I am the one, I am
exactly.
Jesus. Right.
And so forget
your spiritual path. You're just going to believe in my false appeal to authority and my ad verecundium fallacy, and then I'm going to give you the ad baculum fallacy if you don't
exactly.
believe it.
This is what happened. This was how the real spirituality that many of the religions that flow into Christianity represented, this was how they were essentially taken out of history and out of our spiritual life. And
they're still attempting to do that today. Yeah, sorry about that.
Absolutely. The real goal of Roman Christianity was the feudal system. And if you look at how the feudal system operates, you have the Pope as God's representative at the top. You have kings and various positions of church authority and military leaders, and this goes down this long chain of authority. And at the very bottom, you have the serf, who is essentially an animal that does nothing but produce wealth for the people above him. And he is supposed to accept this position because of the theology. And when you look at the feudal system, in my opinion, you have a complete success of the efforts by Caesar to create a theology that will condition the population.
Let's come back to the Stoic philosophy and slavery towards the end.
Sure.
What do you think? All right. I just want to keep with somewhat with the flow of your book.
Oh,
and
go ahead.
I don't want to give too much away too early there. So let's segue here into the woe saying Jesus.
Sure. Well, there are many events in the Gospels that are directly linked to events in Josephus's history. And one of them is this character called the woe-saying Jesus. The woe-saying Jesus in Josephus wanders around. The name of the character is Jesus, which should be a hint as to who the character is written about. He talks about the coming destruction of Jerusalem, and then he repeats over and over again, woe to Jerusalem, woe to these people. Now, this has been seen by many scholars as oddly parallel to the expression by Jesus Christ in the gospel, where in particular passage he starts talking about how Jerusalem will be destroyed and all these bad things will happen, and the expression, woe to Jerusalem, woe to all these people. Now, the fact is that the two characters occur in the same point in the sequence of events. If you overlay the sequence in the military campaign of Titus, you put those events on top of the Gospels, you would see that many of these events are not, you can't really dispute them because they're the same thing, like encircling Jerusalem with a wall or the temple being raised. But these odd, little more complicated parallels, like the woe saying Jesus, when you put that those events into the sequence that the other easy to understand events make, you'll see it fits perfectly. And so the woe saying Jesus is just another of the 50 plus parallels that occur in the same sequence between Titus and Jesus. And just to point out why this is complete proof that the ministry of Jesus is dependent upon the military campaign of Titus Flavius, unusual parallels simply do not occur in this accidentally. It's impossible. There are many famous unusual sequences. The most famous, perhaps, is the Kennedy-Lincoln parallels. People recognize these parallels. They see them as unusual, but if you notice, they don't occur in the same sequence. Sequence is something that has to be understood if you want to understand typology, because sequence has a mathematical power. The authors of the Gospels and Josephus recognized it, and basically it's the same power that exists in DNA evidence, where even though the parallels themselves are not that unusual.
What was the number that you came up with that were the odds?
Well, just in the
254 million
right,
to one.
If
or
you
something?
Just do a calculation of the parallels in the puzzle of the empty tomb, as I refer to, which is a series of events that have a very easy to represent mathematical basis. If you just look at all these events and how they occur in the same sequence, you can see that it couldn't possibly be accidental that the authors are unifying the stories of the empty tomb, of the four different stories of the empty tomb, so that they all fit together to form one story, which gives a different meaning than the surface narration that the four individual stories do. That's a really good example, the puzzle of the empty tomb, of the power of sequence.
What did Mary Magdalene mean in your interpretation?
Well, Mary Magdalene is a title. It just means the rebellious female from Migdal. Mary is Hebrew for rebellious female, and in the Gospels, people have always wondered why so many of the characters who are female are named Mary. Essentially, all of them except a couple are either Mary or Martha, and this is because the word means rebellious female, and to the Roman authors of the Gospels, all of the followers of the Christ were rebellious females, so they presented them in the Gospels as Marys. Mary Magdalene is a character that they came up with, which the town Migdal that Magdalene is representing is the town that the Jewish rebels left from to go into their boats, where the boats were sunk, and then they were fished for men. And it's her name is actually just a joke upon the fact that the fishing fleet was sunk and the Jewish men were fished for by the Romans.
Now, let me ask you this. The word Mary ties in directly to words like marine, mare, from, the ancients believed that the earth and water were female and that male principles were of the sky often. And so we have these associations between Mary and marine and sea and things like that. Do you think that this is another layer going on
could
here?
Well be.
Or what would be your interpretation?
It could well be, because the Mary Magdalene character links directly to the sea imagery that the Romans are developing with their fishing for men story. So it could well be that that's sort of a deeper layer. They have just layer upon layer of symbolism. they are so proud of their cleverness and how they're able.
Well, there's, I'm sorry, Joe. What I notice is that you have this hermetic or maybe even Kabbalistic layering of different meanings. You know, as you go basically through the initiation of the whole thing, you have these, you know, these outward exoteric levels that are for the public, the literal interpretation, and then you have astrotheology, you have drugs and shamanism, you have Titus, you have all of these different things, Elizer, the woe saying Jesus, all piled up one on top of the other as you cut through all of this stuff. And to me, going through all of it, they're all true.
Yeah, it is the case that the thought world of the authors of the Gospels contained knowledge of dozens of religions.
And so these
are all reflective. I think that to really grasp the meaning that the Roman authors had, you want to stay in this level of interpretation, very narrowly defined between Titus's campaign and Jesus's ministry. And I think that this leads to a clear understanding of the Catholicism that the Vatican produced and controls now. It doesn't have a lot to do with, for example, the Gnostic version of Christianity that the Nag Hammadi texts reflect. I think actually that the Gnostic texts and that flavor of Christianity was actually destroyed by Rome. Because for the reason that they didn't want people to follow their individual spiritual paths. They wanted,
sure. And doesn't it seem, Joe, that there is a lot of evidence that the Gnostic ideas were there before the Roman version of Christianity?
Of course, I think that.
Why do you think? Okay, well, when I ask the question, it becomes blatantly obvious. But why do you think that it was so important to eliminate this? This other. Aspect of or this earlier version of Christianity, the Gnostics?
Well, you can't have a well-functioning feudal system if you have a lot of people trying to pursue their own spiritual paths, can you? I mean, that's that,
and thinking for themselves.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The Christians were not called sheep for no reason. Their intellects were deliberately destroyed by the religion. If you look at where Rome was technologically in the first century, they were right on the cusp of the Industrial Revolution. They had very primitive computers. They certainly had mathematical systems that were very well developed. They had architecture and designs that are as modern as our own. They were getting close to the battery. And then 500 years later, people are having a hard time making mud huts. Now, this didn't come about accidentally. The Caesars determined that they needed to end the population's spiritual life and their ability to think independently. They wanted a religion that would produce sheep. And they
usurped the position of the trivium with their own ideology, their own dogma.
You got it.
So, wow. All right. Let's get into your version of the tomb and how you use the story's discussion of the sun as a way to put the story in order between the wars of the Jews and the New Testament.
Well, the puzzle of the empty tomb, as I refer to it, is something that, it's a charming little intellectual puzzle that the Romans put into the Gospels, and it would be something that any person who's listening to this interview has access to the New Testament could actually do on their own. It's really not that difficult. You have four different stories of the coming to Jesus's tomb, and they are contradictory. There's different numbers of people. There's different. The angel is either inside the tomb. Sometimes he's outside the tomb, and they begin at different times of the day. One begins in the dark, one begins as the sun just starts to appear, one begins essentially as morning has just come, and then one occurs just in the day. So you have these four different points of time, and what the reader needs to do is to essentially then connect all of the stories and to make one story. You just take the event that occurs temporally in sequence, and what you end up with is this. You end up with the disciples come to the tomb and run into one another. These aren't angels that are giving them information about the resurrection of Christ. It is just a rumor that is spreading amongst them, and they, in their hysteria, see themselves as angels. So take the way the puzzle is set up. The Gospel of John is one half of it, and then simply take the events of the other three tomb visits, and you'll see that you can actually make a perfect sequence so that when the angel is on the inside, this is when the individual from one story is on the inside of the tomb, and then when there are two people coming and there is one on the outside, it's hard to in verbal terms to explain it, but when you actually just sit there with the New Testament and just list how many people come to the tomb and how many people are on the inside or the outside, it isn't that difficult. You can see that it's designed to show a very ironic and interesting point, that when Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and found it empty at the beginning of the story, because you know it's the beginning of the story because in the Gospel of John, the character Mary comes to the tomb when it's dark, so that's the start of the story, is that she's actually come to Eleazar's tomb. And if you read the Gospels, you'll see that Eleazar has a tomb. It has a stone that's been rolled away. And it has the burial cloths and the sudarium, the face mask, on the floor, so that when Mary Magdalene comes to this tomb that has the stone rolled away and the sudarium on the floor and the burial cloths on the ground, she's simply come to the wrong tomb. And that's the way the story has a kind of a brilliance to it, because it's actually a logic puzzle. And if you, what the Romans are saying is that if you read these stories logically, you will recognize that the character Jesus Christ did not resurrect and come back to life, because the fact is people cannot come back to life. So if you read the story illogically or irrationally, then you will not see you will accept the contradictions between the four stories, and you will also accept the contradiction, in their opinion, that you cannot come back to life.
And I also noticed another parallel theme going on there as I was reading your book and tying directly into Acharya S.'s work there. And as this whole comedy lampoon scene is going on with the tomb, you also have a story going on of the resurrection of the sun. The sun is leaving the chthonic realm, and they're going into this tomb, and the sun isn't there, God's sun isn't there, but at the same time, it's up in the sky. And I couldn't help but notice the two parallel stories that were happening side by side as I was reading your interpretation.
Yeah, they're very sophisticated, and they like to layer their the interpretation that I'm presenting is primarily just focused on the logic of the storyline. The Roman authors were logicians. They were very familiar with the formal principles of logic that Aristotle and Socrates and Plato had developed. And so this was really, in terms of the in terms of what this particular point in the empty tomb stories that they're trying to make, it's really a point of formal logic. They're addressing their meaning to the people that they thought were clear-minded. I think that the Romans were very cynical about religions. If you look at the poetry, for example, of Juvenal, who was, if not a patrician, certainly was very familiar with them, you'll see that he makes the case that the patrician class thought religion was ridiculous, that it was simply a tool to control the masses with. And I think that that attitude is reflected in the Gospels. I think that the layering of these subtle stories, which may have meanings to other religious perspectives, are really not sincere. They're more in the line of religious mockery. You just got to bear in mind that they're producing this literature after a war with a messianic movement. So they're not in the mood to essentially promote any religion at all. They're trying to gain control over rebellious subjects.
You talk about a magical root used to dispel demons, which was rue in the book. Let's segue into that.
Yeah, and this is, you know, as I mentioned, a question that isn't asked a lot about Christianity is what happened to the drugs? You have all of these.
Well, don't ask that about my field, because that's all we study on this side.
And thank heavens, because it's good that someone's actually bringing that perspective back. But it isn't a perspective that's promoted by the Vatican. And
Well, you know, it's funny, Joe. Yeah. Just let me interject here. If you spend 10 minutes looking at Catholic artwork, you know, it always amuses me, because there are as many plants and drugs in the paintings of Catholic art as there are people. And nobody ever focuses on what all of these plants are in these paintings. They only focus on the saints or the characters in the. And there is so much occult symbolism and so many, you know, I published in my last book, 43 Images of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. Professor John Rush has published several hundred in his most recent book, The Mushroom in Christian Art. So, you know, yeah, there is this whole other theme there. Sorry to interrupt you.
And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. It's very curious to me how, why the questions that your research produces are not asked more often by church theologians and by church historians, because it seems to me that you have, when you get to St. Augustine, Eusebius, and the so-called church fathers, they are promoting a kind of ascetic life that is completely under the control of the Pope, and essentially is all set to go for the feudal system. And it's just odd that people don't question as to what happened. How did this particular dry, sterile form of spirituality that is so focused on obedience and focused on essentially Pope worship, how did this come from something as feisty as Messianic Judaism, or as related to spiritual growth as the Gnostic version of Christianity?
Well, you know, and what's interesting is you can follow the path of the Alpha and a shamanic culture as they discover that they can use the powers of the mind and grammar and logic for themselves. And then they withhold this information and they make themselves the chief or the leading shaman. And then that develops into a religious cult with a priest, and that develops into a kingship and then into a full-blown totalitarian society on a global scale like we have today.
Well, that's exactly right. And I just want to point out that the Flavians' perspective, when they started to develop Christianity, was the functioning of the imperial cult. If you really want to know what they had in mind in terms of the subjects of Christianity, as far as obedience and following the instructions of Roman authorities, look at how the imperial cult was set up, because it was created by the Julio-Claudians, the family that had been the Caesars before the Flavians usurped them. And the whole purpose of it was to establish themselves as gods so that the religious inclinations of the subjects would lead them to obedience. Christianity is really just a clever Flavians came up with of the imperial cult. And the imperial cult is not about, in fact, it's just the opposite, and will try to end any individual freedom. They want you to obey. So on one hand, you have, as I see it, on one hand, you have Gnostic Christianity, and on the other hand, you have the feudal system. The Caesars were able to bend the religion so that it formed completely a structure of the feudal system and completely got rid of the forms of the religion and the aspects of the religion and even perhaps the psychedelic connections of the religions.
That we saw what that did in the 60s.
Sure. And so anyway, that, but you can see that it just immediately produces rebellion and individual thinking. This is not, you can't, right. You just cannot run the feudal system with these elements in it. You just really, the thing to do is to just stop for a second and consider, well, how do you get the feudal system to work? How do you get someone to accept being a serf animal and just working brutally his entire life, producing crops which are taken away from him? You really need a kind of religion that does not permit and actually makes a sin out of individual thinking. So this was really what the Caesars had in mind when they set up Christianity in the Vatican.
All right, but let's go into the issue of Rue. And in your book, and I think it was on page 226, you discuss, or you cite Josephus there, and he actually conflates two different plants there. He conflates Syrian rue, which is Paganum harmala, and he also conflates mandrake, which is the plant that we tie a rope around and have a dog drag it out of the ground so that its piercing screams don't kill us. And so in your book, you're discussing how the Romans there are using the entheogens, the psychedelics, for treating demonic possession in the resistance movement as a homeopathic remedy. In other words, the Romans believe that these plants cause or create demons if somebody who's in a normal state takes them. So therefore, these people who are resisting the Roman advance, well, they are possessed by demons. And so therefore, what the Romans are doing is they are giving these psychedelic plants, especially scopolamine, to the captures to give them essentially nightmare visions of demons to de-demonize them. What do you think of that?
The story is an example of the kind of metaphorical license the Romans took with the how they documented Christianity, and they are using the mandrake as a symbol of the Christ, and they construct this metaphor in a number of ways, but the actual technique by which the mandrake, according to Josephus, could be taken out of the ground is very precise, and it had been documented in a work by Pedantius Discordetis, who was essentially the second famous botanist in history. I think the original one, the most famous, was Theophratus or some Greek name that I can't pronounce. But sure. But anyway, Discordetis, his first name was Pedantius, and that the story you're referring to is actually kind of a long series of chained and linked episodes that begins on the Mount of Olives, where Pedantius uses the method that a mandrake can be taken out of the ground with safely to capture the Christ. And so you see.
So in other words, he's tying a rope around it and dragging it out.
Yeah, he's pulling it away and you can only hold it by one hand and holding it out away from your body. Otherwise, you'll die. And so anyway, the character that captures the Christ for Titus, and this is, they're very being strictly metaphorical. This is not historical now. It's just, this is just how they want to present it. His name is Pedantius, and he captures the mandrake. Now, remember that the Christ that the Romans are fighting against is regarded as the root of Jesse or the branch of David. So this is you have these vegetative imageries at the very core of the messianic prophecies. And so that's why the Romans are what they're trying to express is that they are going to domesticate a violent or counterproductive plant. And as I see the as they're developing the metaphor, they don't like how the Christ, as a representative of the mandrake, is creating rebellion. So I think that the way to look at this is that the mandrake produces free thinking. So they need to domesticate it. They need to get it under their control, and they decide that they will graft on. In the Gospels, the New Testament, you have a lot of grafting imagery of how the new Christ will, or Christ will be grafted on to these old messianic branches and roots. And so, in this, as they continue with the story, they have following the war, the Flavian family, Vespasian, Titus, and Domitian are sitting around, and they have Eleazar, who is the original Christ, and they have him captured, and he's sitting there, and they're using him to essentially cause the rebels to get rid of their demonic spirit. In the Gospels, Jesus exercises a number of demons. He's always dealing with this terrible demonic possession that is rampant in Judea as he goes through it. Well, what that is really characterizing is the demonic spirit of the rebels. In other words, the authors of the Gospels are saying anyone who rebels from Caesar has a demonic spirit. And so at the end, they have Eleazar captured and domesticated, and he is using the roux. He actually is using the roux, and as they describe it, he puts it into the nostrils of the Jewish rebels and pulls the demon out of them, at which time the rebel then is free of the devil and collapses to the ground. So
that's a very interesting correlation, because there's a researcher in Jordan who I cite in my book who states that there was actually a preparation made from rue and possibly DMT or dimethyltryptamine from some other plant that they would snort. And so this fits perfectly with what you're saying, but on a different level.
Well, I think that what they're doing with that story is actually essentially alluding to psychedelic drugs that were probably used by the Messianic movement. I don't have any proof of that, because the metaphors are broad stroked, but as I interpret it, that is essentially what the meaning is that if you know they are saying that we are going to use your psychedelic drugs in a way to control your mind. You're not going to be free with them any longer. You're going to be controlled by them. And basically, they're just saying that we have got this character Jesus, the root, the messianic root, and instead of being something that will lead to rebellion and freedom of thinking, he's now going to be an agent of the Roman bad trip. And the bad trip lasted for 2,000 years, and it's still going on.
Right. Well, you know, and interestingly, the modern psychedelic movement was launched by Gordon Wasson, who I mentioned was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he was also, ironically, the account manager for the Vatican for J.P. Morgan Bank.
What a shock.
I'm shocked. So who were Simon and John in all of this?
Well, the Gospels lampoon the real Messianic family, which was the Maccabee family. The Maccabee family drove the Gentiles out in 166 BCE, and they were essentially the Messianic family. They had very particular names. There was Matthew, Judas, John, Simon, Eleazar. And so when the Romans write the Gospels, they use these names as a way to mock the real Messianic family. The two leaders of the rebellion, other than Eleazar, were named Simon and John. And so they in the Gospels, these kind of buffonic ne'er-do-wells that are the apostles are just ways of mocking and making fun of the military leaders of the Messianic movement. And again, here's just a real simple way that someone who's listening can check how clear the parallels are between the military campaign of Titus and the Gospels. You just go to John 21 and look at the prophecies that Jesus has for Simon and John. And Simon is going to be taken where he doesn't want to go, and he's going to be executed in a way that'll glorify God, and he will be bound. John, on the other hand, will not die. He's going to be around, and it's none of Simon's business what his fate is, but he's not going to die. So that's John 21. It's very easy to read. It only takes a few seconds. Then just look on the internet on the history of Josephus and go to the conclusion of it, and you'll see that the two leaders, Simon and John, are captured. Simon is taken to Rome. He's bound. He's executed in a way to glorify the deified Caesars, whereas John is given life imprisonment. Very complicated parallel, very easy to understand, and that's the way that the Gospels and Josephus's story.
And how do they tie to the Maccabees?
Well, the family that was leading the rebellion against Rome were most likely descendants of the original Maccabean family. You can tell this by the names that Josephus recorded. They were Judas.
Yeah, what were the five sons of Matthias?
Right. Matthias had five sons, Judas, John, Simon, Eleazar, and I believe Jonathan. And these individuals will appear in the Gospels. I mean, obviously Simon, John, Eleazar, Matthew, or Judas are well-known disciples. And, you know, there are other characters that they blend in the story, but they have the position of authority. They're the ones that have the most storyline given to them. And what the authors are doing is they're just mocking the Messianic movement. The Gospels are a prediction of the war against the Messianic movement, and they are a mockery of the Messianic movement that fought against Rome.
Who are the authors of the New Testament?
There were three groups involved. One were the story team that the Flavians had that was led by Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Elder was the most erudite individual in the Roman Empire, could speak a whole bunch of languages, and certainly understood literature and propaganda very well. The Flavians also had two families that were Jewish ethnically, or at least claimed it, but were in their employment and were had abandoned their faith and were, in fact, leading the military attack on the Messianic movement. These families were the Herods and the Alexanders. So the Gospels would have been created by the Flavian propaganda team that Pliny the Elder led, and he would have been assisted by the Alexander and the Herods, who had the technical understanding of Hebraic literature and the prophecies and how the Hebraic typology operated, so that they could essentially make a new covenant, which is what the expression New Testament really means. They could create this new covenant that would lead to this character, the Son of Man, that Jesus predicts, which, of course, is Titus.
What are the types of story outlines that were used in the creation of the New Testament? Can you describe those?
Well, there's two branches of typology. The first one is the pre-ministry of Jesus. And there you have events from the Old Testament, particularly those that relate to Moses, and these are placed into the story of Jesus as a child and before his ministry begins, and they're done so because they want to typologically link their character, Jesus Christ, to Moses, because Moses was responsible for the Old Covenant that their New Covenant is going to replace. So these stories were Joseph going from Judea down to Egypt, the massacre of the innocents, There's a verbatim statement that they are dead who sought the child's life. Then you have a baptism, essentially a journey through water. You now are in the wilderness. In the Old Testament, you're there for 40 years with Jesus. You're for 40 days. And then there are three episodes with temptation of by bread and do not tempt God and worship only God. So these seven events in Jesus's pre-ministry are all completely developed from the story of the Old Testament. And they're easy to spot. They're, you know, the symbolism is not hard for anyone, even a layman can recognize it. And because they occur in the same sequence, you have just a real simple way to know that the character Jesus is fiction. He isn't a historical character. He's being developed as a typologic character out of the Old Testament. So you also have in that system of typology, you have a primer for what's going to happen in Jesus' adult ministry. The typologic system in the gospel uses names, locations, and concepts that occur in the same sequence. And this was done in the parallels that linked Jesus backwards in time to Moses. And they are also, it is the same system that then links Jesus forward in time to Titus Flavius.
You want to write about the Apostle Paul. What are you willing to tell us today?
Well, I have a new book that will be out hopefully parallel with the documentary that was done by Fritz Eden and Neola Sparkas on Caesar's Messiah. And that book is called The Single Strand, and it will show that following the creation of what's called the Synoptic Gospels by Titus and Vespasian that focus on the Father and the Son of God that have this experience through Judea, following the death of Titus, Domitian, who is the youngest son, was jealous of their leaving him out of the story, essentially. And so he developed his own Jesus, and this was the character Paul, and he uses the character to link to his history, which was recorded not by Josephus, but by Suetonius. And I show that the character Paul is just another typologic fiction, and that all of the events that he claims to have are fictional, and that you can demonstrate this by showing how they relate to events in the life of Caesar Domitian, the last of the Flavian Caesars.
Let's talk about the testimonium. Why is it important, and how does it relate to Paul?
Well, the testimonium is certainly the most famous historical documentation of the character Jesus Christ, and there's just been an enormous amount of controversy about it. Many, many people think that it's a fraud. They believe that it was interpolated by a Christian zealot, redactor later in history, and that it wasn't in the original versions. And they have a lot of different ways of trying to justify the position. But unfortunately, this position is simply because they try to read this literature as either history or religion. And this is the big problem. This is the big problem that has led to Christianity still being in existence, is that people are looking at the wrong genre. If you try to analyze this stuff as history or as religious literature, you'll never understand it. All of it is typology. It's all a kind of linked literature that the meaning is related from one text to the other. And if you don't understand how that genre operates, you're just not going to make any progress. In the case of the testimonium, it's actually a story that stands out very much from the historical narration that Josephus is engaged in at this time in the book, which is exclusively about Pontius Pilate. He's described some activities in Judea and the problems he's having, and then all of a sudden you have this abrupt break in the narration and you have the testimonium. But That's just one of three stories. There are two other tales that are directly adjacent to the testimonium, which are in fact typology that are linked together with the testimonium to tell a little story about the creation of Christianity, and specifically about how Domitian came to control Christianity. And it's a little too complicated to just to go in without having the text to explain how they operate. But I would just tell people to buy Caesar's Messiah, and you can see that that the testimonium is indeed a fraud, but it's all a fraud. It's all fiction. The Gospels are completely fiction. The histories of Josephus are also fiction. This is just typologic literature that has this meaning that you have to read it in the right genre to be able to understand.
What was the Roman practice of devotio?
Devotio was the idea that one individual would sacrifice himself so that the greater group could live. It was particularly used in military campaigns where things were really going bad, and the Romans were essentially getting wiped out. You'd have one guy would make his peace with the gods, and then he would go out by himself and essentially sacrifice his life. And the idea was that the sacrifice of his life would cause the gods of war to look on the Romans benevolently, and then their fate would change in the battlefield.
Didn't they honor all of the gods?
Yes, and they honored all of the gods in the devotio, particularly in the ones that you're referring to that are linked the testimonium. That would be the devotio of Decius Mus, who was one of the very, very famous Roman heroes who sacrificed his life in a religious manner during war to turn the tide. And he was sacrificing the gods. And in the complicated testimonian typology that I refer to in the book, it's probably a way of just showing that that Christianity is just one of the many imperial cult religions that Caesar owned and operated.
Why was Christianity used to usurp Judaism?
Well, it wasn't really done to usurp Judaism. There was various forms of Judaism, one of which Rome essentially controlled through the Herodians. The Herodians had a control over the legal structure of a branch of Judaism, which was non-violent. Typically, these were Jews that were making money within the Roman Empire and were very happy with the current system. Christianity was really created to slow down the missionary activity of a particular strand of Judaism, which is to say the Messianic Judaism that led to the rebellions.
And that's the Sakkari movement,
right? Exactly, the Sakkari. Would have been one of the ways that you would have described this movement would have been the Sakkari or the Zealots, however you wanted to characterize them. They were just the religious fanatics that rebelled against Rome,
sort of like some might describe the Zionists today, maybe.
Yeah, I think there is actually quite a lot of parallels between certainly the fundamental forms of Judaism that are so extremely Zionistic, and the literature of the Messianic movement. The Dead Sea Scrolls, in my opinion, are indeed the literature of the Messianic movement. And if you look at the political position of the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's very militaristic, very violent.
Sure, the war documents, you have the Teacher of Righteousness and all this stuff.
Yeah, you have the Teacher of Righteousness, but you have really severe religious asceticism. They're out in the camps. They have punishments for every imaginable small indiscretion, and they are just completely xenophobic. They do not want any Gentiles in their area. They want to be essentially a pure nation that is within the boundaries that they feel were given to them by God, and they, you know, talk about killing the head of the Kittim to, you know, get rid of these people. So this form of Judaism is messianic, phobic, militaristic, and that's really what Christianity was. They were trying to produce a religion that would essentially be an antidote to calm it down, to slow down its military activities. And then once they were able to do that, then they wanted the religion to essentially become larger and pacify people everywhere.
Earlier, you mentioned that Titus and Vespasian equated to the Trinity. Would you discuss that? How does that relate?
Well, interesting thing to do is to simply go on the internet and to look at the Arch of Titus, which commemorates Titus's military victories over the Jews. And if you look on the arch, you'll see that Vespasian and Titus are claimed to be God the Father and the Son of God. The Roman Senate bestowed a deification, they called it making them a deus, on a very few Caesars. Most Caesars were not given this honor, but Titus and Vespasian were, and they became gods, and they are reflected as God the Father and the Son of God in the gospel story. Whenever you have in the, you know, God the Father is in heaven and he's looking down on his Son and he says, I am pleased. This is really just a very crude symbolic way of talking about Vespasian's relation to Titus during the military campaign. But there is another Flavian Caesar, Domitian, and he is represented as the terrible spirit or the Holy Ghost, as it's sometimes called. And these three individuals are represented as the Trinity. And the sign of the cross, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, is a way of giving respect to the actual creators of the Christian religion.
How did Josephus use the prophecies of Daniel to make it appear as though Jesus was actually predicting the future?
Well, it's just a completely absurd event.
Well, you know, and this is such an important topic here because whenever you bring up that Jesus was a non-historical character, you know, and I've done some pretty major radio interviews, and somebody be like, well, you know, forget the post hoc fallacy, but they'll be throwing out all of this type of stuff that, well, Jesus predicted or fulfilled all of Daniel's predictions and yada, yada, so it's got to be
right,
true.
That's
so,
right. Well,
here's the crux of the whole thing right here in my
opinion.
It's
very important, and it's so obvious, and yet so few people, even secular theologians or secular historians talk about it. But Josephus claims, now he has to falsify dates in order to do this, obviously, but he claimed that the war between the Roman and the Jews lasted exactly 7 years. And he claims that at the exact midpoint of the war, an event occurred that Jesus predicted, which is the abomination of desolation, that essentially one of the prophecies of Daniel. So that in the Gospels, the character Jesus Christ says, there's going to be an abomination of desolation, and it's going to occur. And it's one of the prophecies that he makes, including the city of Jerusalem will be encircled with a wall and the temple be razed. And he specifically states that Daniel's abomination of desolation will occur. Josephus then claims that this comes to pass because he claims that the abomination of desolation occurred at exactly 3.5 years from the beginning of the war. Now, this is pure fantasy because what he's doing is he's mimicking Daniel's prophecy, which is set in what are called weeks, which are 7 year periods. And Daniel says that the abomination of desolation will occur at the midpoint of a week. So that when Josephus recorded that indeed the abomination of desolation occurred exactly 3.5 years from the start of the war, he is obviously falsifying because we know miracles don't really happen and no one can actually see into the future. So this is clear fiction and it links directly without any controversy to the prediction that Jesus makes. So in other words, here you have fiction that the Gospels are predicting and the so-called historian is recording. And I think that this is just such clear evidence of the dependency that exists between Titus's military campaign and the Gospels that no one, no clear-minded person can really argue against it.
How did Josephus create time in history?
He actually created the dates that we use to chronicle time with.
Are you familiar with Anatoly Fomenko?
No.
The Russian mathematician and astronomer who's published a series of five or six books called History, Science, or Fiction, wherein he reveals how all of the timeline for the last 2,000 years is off by about 1,000 years. He says that we're actually in about 1,000 CE now.
Could well be. I don't have direct history memory of any of this, but I know that Josephus actually used the destruction of Jerusalem as the basis for the chronology that the Vatican claims is true, because you know it claims that we're in the year 2012, and that links to the year one, which is the point of where Jesus is born. But actually, the reason why Jesus was claimed to be born in the year one is simply to reflect the 70 weeks of that Daniel envisioned would occur before the events in his prophecies come to pass. And so what they do is they simply start with their famous military victory in the destruction of Jerusalem, and then they work backwards. And that gives us the series of chronology that the Vatican claims we're living within.
Stoic philosophers, how is Jesus reminiscent of them?
Well, he is telling his disciples and the people listening to him that they don't really need to worry, that God will be there to help them. And this is, as many people have noticed, is very similar to the Stoic philosophy that Seneca promoted. Seneca historians have seen very, very direct parallels between Seneca's philosophy in Stoicism and the philosophy that Jesus is producing. And what's important to remember is that when Seneca was telling people that they should be happy with their plight in life, that individuals are wealthy if only they can simply be satisfied with the circumstances that God has given them, you have to remember that Seneca owned 10,000 slaves. So the philosophy is very, very suspicious, and I think it's just transparently cynical. He's just trying to come up with a way to keep his slaves pacified. So when you see that philosophy filter into the Gospels, I think you're simply looking at the mindset of the authors, that they wanted to have the poor people and the slaves not worry about the future, because they knew that could lead to rebellion. So,
you mean kind of like politics today?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean,
so there's a correlation here.
Well, direct correlation. I call Romney, Santorum, and Gingrich the three horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, and then you know, Rahm Emanuel, his father was one of the Zionist terrorists, and now he's mayor of Chicago, and oh yeah, his brother is Michael Moore's handler, so that's a whole other segue there. But so how was Christianity, and of course we're touching on this, but how was Christianity used as a system of mind control for the slave class?
Well, it's pretty much self-evident. If you look at where the peasant is in terms of his consciousness in, say, the 5th, 7th, 10th century, you can see that it's completely dominated by the Vatican, and it's dominated theologically. In other words, the story of Jesus and the consequences of disobedience to the Pope are now ingrained in the peasant as religious decrees, that they are essentially, by their obedience to the authorities, they are giving obedience to Jesus. And this was the real purpose of Christianity. Caesar had a title of Pontus Maximus. That was one of the Caesar's official names, and it meant the head of the College of Roman Priests. So there really wasn't much transition. Caesar just got rid of one title, Caesar, kept the other, Pontiff Maximus. He didn't even leave the house that he was living in. He stayed in the Vatican. And somehow, instead of having the ability to rebel against a corrupt political system that was enslaving you, the peasant was obeying the Pope because this was how you express love for Jesus.
Sure. You know, I've always said that Rome never fell. It never fell.
No, unfortunately, it never did. It was just very subtle. People didn't understand what Rome really was. Rome became the Vatican.
They just converted.
Yeah, exactly. The Vatican became Rome. The whole point was keeping the peasant class enslaved by wars and spies and beatings. Very expensive. Very complicated.
Yeah, confessionals work exactly. Much better for spying.
Exactly. So therefore, we just have to get the peasant's mind to be structured correctly, and that's what Christianity did.
Should we talk about who the 12 apostles were?
Well, they're fictional characters. The best known ones are simply they're lampoons of the Maccabee families. Others of them, I think, are actually ways of sort of beginning to develop Roman Christianity. You have disciples that are called tax collectors. And I think this is very suspicious. And I think that the tax collecting disciples of Jesus are definitely just a way of, they're trying to blend the xenophobic messianic movement with a more pro-Roman one, and specifically with a version of messianic Judaism that will pay its taxes, because this was what kept the empire rolling, and they didn't want any religion getting between them and their tax collecting. And so they just created these absurd characters who any historian can see could not have possibly existed, because in this era, messianic Judaism was a very xenophobic, anti-Roman movement, and there is absolutely no way it would have included tax collectors of the Roman Empire.
I heard mention that you may have discovered something about who Shakespeare was. Would you like to discuss that?
Well, I think that the Shakespearean literature, the understanding of it will shift once people understand the typology of the Gospels. And when you really see how the Gospels are structured and what they mean, you're going to have a lot of the literature of Western civilization change its meaning, because I wasn't the very first person to understand the typology and the comic mockery level of the Gospels. Quite a few authors have understood it. They, for a number of reasons, couldn't go public, but they have recorded their understanding of the Gospels in their literature. And in the case of Shakespeare, essentially, much of the literature is just an attempt to reverse the meaning that the authors of the Gospels have created. I'll just give you a quick example. Titus Andronicus, at the conclusion, has Titus getting the rulers of the Gentiles to eat human flesh without their knowing it. This simply reverses the Last Supper, where the Romans, in their comic theology literature, are describing the Jewish royal family eating human flesh without their knowing it. So there's a lot of the symbolism of Shakespeare that will become, the understanding of it will change, and a lot of it will finally be understood once people start to realize that the author had a good understanding, a very clear understanding of the typologic level of the Gospels.
Would you care to give a hint as to who the author was? Did you discover the author?
Sure. The author of Shakespeare was a woman named Emilia Bassano. She was produced essentially all of the literature, with the exception, I think, of some of the histories, which I believe were probably at least begun by Christopher Marlowe, who also understood the actual level, the typologic level of the Gospels. Emilia Bassano, even though she is not given any attention as a potential author of the literature, she's an obvious candidate. She wrote a poem that was the very first copyrighted poem by a woman in the English language called Hail God, King of the Jews. And in the poem, you get pithy expressions like all the world is a stage. Furthermore, she... her family came from the area near Verona, so that the mystery of why Shakespeare has all of these Italian-situated plays is cleared up. Emilia was a language tutor and spoke the languages that are reflected by in the literature, Italian, Latin, French. She was actually one of the more linguistically fluent people in Britain at the time. So, her family was Jewish. They'd been brought to Britain by Henry VIII to be court musicians. And the family had the understanding of the typologic level. And it is reflected in Emilia's work. And in fact, just to give you an example, even her nom de plume, Shakespeare, has a meaning. It is essentially just the declaration by someone who feels that Christianity is destroying them, and she's saying, no, we're not going to die. We are shaking a spear. We'll shake spear. That's the meaning of the nom de plume that she took.
Let's talk about the new film that you're just about to release, Caesar's Messiah. What would you like to tell us about
that?
Well,
it's just the greatest movie ever made. Anyone who hasn't seen it just should essentially give up everything.
Now, is it public yet, or
no,
is it
going
not
to be
public?
Released very quickly? You'd want to talk to Fritz Heed or Neola Sparkas about the schedule for the release. But
and is that going to be available for free viewing on the internet, or is that going to be purchase only? Are we doing open source or otherwise?
Otherwise, it will be for something of this stature. The money that you spend will be the best investment you've ever made in your life. And I would encourage everyone that is interested in Caesar's Messiah to see it, because, I mean, first of all, I don't know if you've seen it. Have you seen it, Jan?
I have seen it, yes.
I feel that it's a fair description to say that there's really interesting new information. And it's just very, very well made. I think people will get a lot out of it, and I encourage everyone who has read Caesar's Messiah to look at it.
What would you say to people to warn them about the way governments and the elite can create religions to control and manipulate them? And what would be your warning to the public, to the audience?
You had to ask. Well, I would say that the real meaning of Caesar's Messiah is that the government and rulers have used masks. They hide what they really are so that the populace will accept foreign policy and government activity, which is against their self-interest. I mean, the serf should not have been happy about being a slave, but because the Pontiff Maximus had such an effective mask of the Christian religion, the serf put up with it. I think that relationship should be in every citizen's mind. Whenever you hear any proclamation from a ruler, I think that the understanding of how to control citizens, how to control populations, is well understood by the ruling class. It is going on today, and I can only say that the the very best thing that someone can do is to become more alert, more wary of the techniques that government use to put on a mask so they can hide the real meaning and what's really behind their foreign policy, the taxation, you know, and the ways that they get elected, what the promises they make. Caesar's Messiah has really led me to a very, very skeptical place in terms of government.
Well, that's funny that you should mention that, because I was just going to mention Stefan Molyneux, who will be on the show this week, and I'm going to put you on right after him. And then I just did a series of interviews with Larkin Rose, who is the author of The Most Dangerous Superstition. And if you have not read that book, I recommend you put it on the top of your must-read list, because what he does is he reveals that government is the biggest cult of all, and that if everyone stopped believing in the belief in authority, that governments would instantly lose their power and we could all go back to being free overnight.
It's a pleasant thought. I think that the sheep are very well conditioned at this point, and it's going to take a really powerful process to...
It's gonna take a meme, but you know what? We see memes spread across the internet very quickly, like the Zeitgeist movement and things like that. And
yeah, that's exactly right.
If the right places pick it up, it could really take hold and spread like wildfire.
And I want to very sincerely just congratulate you on your site and your work, because the internet is the very first tool that the citizens have really had to fight back against government propaganda. And so I would just hope that everyone that listens to your show supports it and supports you and supports all of the other shows that have cropped up on the internet, because for the first time, real citizen information can be given out in a very public way. This is the very first time that the citizens have had a chance to determine what is real and what is in their benefits and share the information. And so the faster that we can get the internet to be a replacement of the mainstream media and use as a tool whereby citizens can determine what's real and what is in their interest, the better.
Which is, of course, why they're doing everything to strip our right to freedom away from the internet as quickly as possible.
As long as it stands, let's use it as best we can. And you're to be commended. Good job, buddy.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And what is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Well, to buy the book. I would say that would be because typology is a pretty complicated thing. And in interviews, I don't want to get too much into the specifics of it, because frankly, it will bore people. And I think in this context where you can't, you know, use the entire arc of understanding that you can in a book, I'm really personally, I think the documentary will be the device that will bring these ideas into culture, just because it's just so much easier to grasp when you're looking at it visually. But I would say right now, the first thing to do is to buy the book, to read it, to get an understanding of how the typology operates. It's really, once you get into it, it's not that difficult to understand, and you will come to such a new understanding of your history. And then, of course, the documentary, you should buy it, and I would suggest people watch it once a day for about 3 years. That will clear their minds up, and you'll know who to vote for. Ron Paul.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should mention Ron Paul, because getting into the statist philosophy, we're going to have to make a quick segue here. But when you study Ron Paul, you'll realize that he'll be completely incapable of doing anything that he...
True.
Interestingly, I have a friend who's... running for president by the name of Clint Richardson, and he's done a documentary film investigation on Ron Paul and his audit the Fed bill, and shows that all Ron Paul's Fed bill does is put a web link up on the Fed's website to the already existing audit.
Yeah, I agree. And it's the reason I bring up Ron Paul is simply because at least he raises issues that need to be addressed. In other words,
but a red herring, or still working towards statist philosophy, is still keeping them in power.
Well, I do agree. I would simply note that it is that there isn't anyone else that is on the stage that brings any of these ideas, particularly in terms of the Federal Reserve, to the public's awareness. If you're looking for Santorum, Gingrich, or Romney to give you a history of the Federal Reserve, how it came about, you know, why it is, it's not going to occur. So,
what I'm getting at here with my friend Clint Richardson is he's done a full expose on the comprehensive annual financial reports of how government and the entire system works, and he shows that the Federal Reserve is actually being used as a red herring to keep people from focusing on the real issue of how government is run through the comprehensive annual financial reports. And this is another big issue that people need to catch on to and pay attention to, because what the government is doing is, through taxation, what they do is, okay, they tax us, they take all of our tax money, and then they invest it in these massive funds, stock holdings all over the place, and they don't tell the public about any of the returns on these investments. And the investments are so large and have accumulated so much wealth that we would never need to pay again, ever. And so what they do is they only tell us what they call the budget, and then they keep this comprehensive annual financial report and all of the information it contains from us. And then they report what the budget contains, which is licensing, taxes,
yeah,
and things. And so they're.
No, I don't think the SERF was given a detailed budget of the Vatican's party activity at the end of each year.
Sure. I think Reserve is a lawman or a red herring to get people to focus on the wrong issue, to get people to go boycott Wall Street when they should be at their local city hall, because it's your local city hall who owns a lot of these.
I really think that, and I hope the internet will help bring this about, is that the first step is local activity. You need to take back local government and something that will serve the interests of the citizens. Right now,
sure, make it anarchy.
Yeah, we'll just do it one step at a time, brother. But right now we have we just have these petty bureaucrats that are in the pockets of wealthy individuals that keep everyone calm, and that no one knows where the tax money is going. No one knows where the currency swaps the Federal Reserve creates go. There just is no accounting, and this is America has become almost overnight exposed as a banana republic. It's going to end badly, and I just would hope that the work of the Caesar's Messiah documentary and the book will help people get an understanding of how governments operate, because this will help them prepare for the future, which is not going to be sunny.
Joe, your websites and book titles?
Go to caesarsmessiah.com. And there you'll see a page that has the various products, Flavian Signature, a little video piece they can buy that has an encapsulation of the core discoveries. They can buy Caesar's Messiah on Kindle, hardback, straight download. So go there, and you'll also very soon be able to purchase the documentary. We're doing it. Oh, and there at the website, there is a blog where they can ask questions. I'm happy to answer any questions about the theory or anything else. And I also am constantly putting out pieces of new research that I do just for the entertainment and edification of anyone who wants to come on the blog and check it out.
All right, Joe, thank you so much, and I've very much enjoyed our time today in this interview, and I know the audience will quite enjoy it. And anyway, thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Jan. And I just, the sun never sets on your empire.
Thank you, Joe.